I'm your host, Andrea Weckerly, and welcome to the Ready Living Podcast, where each episode is designed to educate, inspire, and empower you to create the life you want. My guest today is Alexander Verbeek. He is a former diplomat who works independently as an environmentalist, writer, and public speaker. Over the past 30 years, he has worked on international security, humanitarian and geopolitical risk issues, and the linkage to the Earth's accelerating environmental crisis. He created the Planetary Security Initiative, launched at the Peace Palace in The Hague in 2015. He's an expert speaker and advisor on planetary change for academia, global NGOs, private firms, and international organizations. He is also the policy director at the Brussels Environment and Development Resource Center. Alexander is a recognized online leader in climate change advocacy with over 450,000 social media followers and writes the Planet newsletter on Substack. Welcome, Alexander.
Happy to be here.
What I love about your work is that you take a big picture approach to looking at the state of the world and in offering solutions, but then also bring things to the local and even personal levels through the stories you share in your newsletter, The Planet, and your prolific social media accounts. Later, we'll talk about leadership, planetary security, climate diplomacy, and governance, but I want to start with your Camino de Santiago pilgrimage. In the summer of 2022 and 2023, both years, I believe, you walked the 500 miles, 825 kilometer historical Camino de Santiago route, which means the Way of St. James in English. It's a network of ancient pilgrimage routes that lead to Santiago de Compostela in Spain, and you extensively chronicled your journey, which took weeks to complete, sharing videos on YouTube and writing about it in your newsletter. Can you share with us what inspired you to make the journey not just once, but twice?
It's a long story that got me there. Its earliest roots is that when I was about 18, I read Hemingway's Fiesta, The Sun Also Rises. After I read that, I always kept in mind the idea to someday go to Pamplona, where part of the story is playing. And it took me about 30 years to go to Pamplona. And when I was finally there, about 8 years ago now, I saw everywhere those pilgrims, people of all ages walking around with backpacks, all walking west towards Santiago de Compostela. And that was for me a fascinating thing. And since then, I got this kind of virus that people get that they feel that they want to make that pilgrimage someday. So I started reading about it, watching YouTube videos, and I decided to do it. And then once I had walked the whole thing, that takes about 5 weeks or so, I did it again the next year, and I would probably have walked another Camino this year if I would have had the time. But I think next year, somewhere, I'll be walking another pilgrimage again.
Oh, that's exciting. And my understanding is that there isn't just one Camino de Santiago. It's various possible routes that end in Santiago. So how did you choose your particular route?
Yes, there's an endless amount of routes, because if you look at the origin of the pilgrimages, was that the local priest in a village said to somebody, you have to walk to Santiago. So the route has many beginnings, but only an endpoint. And there's, I think, close to 300 official routes. And there's about 10 of them that most people know that are the most famous ones. That's where all these pilgrims met each other while walking towards Santiago. And the closer you come, the more it became a kind of highway of pilgrims. And the most famous one, the biggest one, the one that is walked by most modern pilgrims, that is the French Camino. It starts in France, starts in a small village called Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port in the Pyrenees. And from there, it is still, I think, about 800 kilometers to walk. The first day you cross the Pyrenees Mountains, on day one, you're already in Spain, but then still Spain is very big. You have to follow the long route through Spain. A few other famous ones are the one that follows the coastline, so a little bit more north of the Camino Francés, Camino del Norte, or you can start in Lisbon or in Porto, Portugal. So there's the Portuguese route, and there's quite a few other ones. And there's people that start at home, wherever they live. I once met somebody who had started in Poland. It was an enormous trip, of course. There's people that start in the Netherlands, I've seen. I've met those as well. But there's a few routes that start in France, Paris and Arles and Le Puy and Anvers, I think. And all those routes come together finally in this French route that so many people take. Maybe if somebody thinks about doing this and doing a Camino for the very first time, this is maybe the most accessible one because so many people walk it. There's a better infrastructure to take care of you.
That's good to know. And I was wondering if you'd prepared in any way for the trip.
Hardly. I was planning to. I like walking, so I didn't need too much preparation, I think. The overwhelming majority of people that start walking it were planning to practice, but found out that in normal life, you don't have enough time to practice, so they hardly practiced. I remember people saying that they once walked for 8 or 10 kilometers, and that was the only practice. And I think that counts for most people. You don't really need to. The first days is a bit tough because you are crossing the Pyrenees. I think anybody that's basically in reasonable health can walk this. You don't have to do a certain amount per day. If you want to walk only 15 kilometers a day, you can do that too. If you want to walk 40 a day, you can also do it. Most people do about 20, I think, on average.
During your 2022 journey, pilgrims were prevented from walking the Camino between Pamplona and Logroño due to forest fires. So you had to travel that portion by car. And you also described walking during an extreme heat wave and suffering through poor air quality due to wildfires. In fact, even sleeping with an N95 mask on. How did experiencing the fires, extreme heat, and poor air quality shape your perspective of the urgency of addressing environmental issues?
Yes, it was a very strange coincidence. One of the reasons that I wanted to walk is that I've been working on climate change issues for decades. And that's a very depressing story because it's getting worse and worse. We're not doing enough, even though we know exactly what causes it. We know how to solve it. We can pay for it, but we don't have the leadership and the policy and the guts to really do what we need to do. So because that's kind of a negative thing, I started to increasingly focus more on nature and spend more time on nature. And that ultimately led to the idea of walking the Camino so I could be away from that negative issue of climate change. And the next thing that happened, while I was walking there, I was caught by climate change. There were absurd heat waves in a way they never had before in 2022. Somebody close to where I was walking died. There were forest fires on a scale never seen before. So while I was trying to get away from climate change, the climate change was out there in my face. I remember having the feeling that it was kind of unfair. I spent so much time on climate change, and now I wanted a break from it. And then suddenly there it was, and which is, of course, kind of the definition by climate change. It gets everybody. And there's a lot of stories about unfairness, and I'm the last person in the world that should complain living in a Western country in Europe.
Aside from some of the challenges you experienced during a portion of that trip, the trip as such sounds really, really wonderful. And as a result, I'm inspired to do it myself one day. And I'm wondering if there are any particular places that left an impact on you.
Oh, I could talk for hours. I don't know how long you want to do the podcast, but we could fill a 5-hour podcast of everything that I like. But just to mention, also a bit as an example of how it feels, I think the first that comes to mind is the Meseta. That is the middle part of, let's say it's about 30 days, 35 days to walk this. So somewhere between, let's say, day 10 and day 20, you walk for about 10 days in an area that is flat and hot. And some people call it boring because there's no interesting cities. There's not much happening there. There's not many pilgrims either, because a lot of pilgrims, once they arrive in Burgos, they take a train or a bus and they just skip those 10 days and they continue somewhere after León, where it gets more lush and green and maybe more interesting. I think that is a waste for anybody walking it who is thinking about skipping that part, because for me, before I go to sleep at night and I'm transferring myself back into one of those caminos, it is often pictures of the Meseta that comes to mind, where because you are in the middle of it, you've forgotten that you once started this journey. There's no end in sight yet because Santiago de Compostela is still far away. You come in this rhythm where early in the morning before sunrise, you get up, you get your stuff, and you just start walking west, and you're all alone, and slowly you see the sun rising, and colors reappear, and sounds reappear. You're just walking there, and it is just you and your thoughts. Your body is by that time adjusted to this rhythm. So the first pains and blisters, etc., are gone, but your mind isn't yet. And this is the time, because you're so alone and there's so little distraction, that you can just walk for miles and miles and just let your mind float and process everything that you wanted to process, or just keep your mind completely empty, which is kind of refreshing as well.
It sounds absolutely wonderful. All the more reason to want to do this. During the journey, you also stopped at Cruz Faro. Can you tell us about the practice of leaving a stone and what it represents? And I believe you did something like that too.
It's a very old tradition. This started about 1,200 years ago, when the true believers say that it's the body of St. James that was found and that was buried in Santiago. And soon after, Spanish people and later Christians from all over Europe started to walk there. So walking this Camino is a 1,200-year tradition. You're in their footsteps, whether you're religious or not, but that historical connection is there. And one of the many traditions on the Camino is that you carry a stone in your backpack. There are different explanations, but most people see it as you carry your burden. You can leave that behind at this Cruz de Ferro. So it's an iron cross on top of a wooden pole. There's nowadays about 500,000 people a year that walk to Santiago. I think the large majority follows this route. Let's say about half of them carries a stone. So we're easily at a few 100,000 people dropping a stone there every year. So it's by now a huge pile. Many people have written messages on it. You see some people just, you know, jolly passing by throwing on a stone, but you see far more people that really take time to contemplate on the stone that they brought there. And for many, that stone has a meaning. It comes from the grave of a loved one or all kinds of other connections. And people leave also other things behind. So it's a beautiful moment because it's also very close to the highest point of the Camino. Most people arrive there very early in the morning. After that, you start a very long knee-breaking descent and a completely new part of the Camino starts. So it's a rite of passage that you go, that you stop at the Cruz de Ferro.
May I ask where you brought a stone from?
I took it from my own garden. Does it really represent something? Well, actually, I was such a coward to bring a very small stone, so it can't represent too much. You have some people bringing really a huge stone, and then I just wonder, did they pick it up next to the road, or did they really bring that for like hundreds of kilometers?
It sounds like you brought a pebble.
Yeah, it was a little bit more than a pebble, but I wasn't very brave, I guess.
Oh, that's great. I love it. Can you tell us a little bit about the pilgrims you met on the way?
Yeah, it's one of the fantastic things of the Camino. It is an amazing combination of people. You see all different ages and gender and ethnicity and nationalities. I walked with people from South Korea and from South Africa and from Brazil, and I could mention many, many other places. I've met a few very devout Christians. I've met many atheists, or however they describe themselves, that are not walking for religious reasons. I've met Jews, I've met Muslims. Basically, everybody walks there. And two things on that. One is that you hear amazing stories of people that you would normally never meet in your life because you don't meet them through your work or in any other way. And suddenly now you spend a whole day walking with people that have fantastic stories to tell. Many people have a reason why they walk the Camino. I think it's probably less than half that's purely there for religious reasons, but I think it's the majority that feels that this is a kind of phase in life where they need to take a break from whatever happened before that could be health-related or family-related or processing a big loss in any kind of form. So people have a lot of stories to tell. They have a lot to learn. I think the thought that perhaps me as a former diplomat maybe, is that in a time where worldwide there is so much hatred, and we see daily in the news leaders stirring up the hatred between different groups that are immigrants or different nationalities or different beliefs or whatever. You see it every day all over the world. And then here you have the most wide mix you could think of, and everything goes in harmony. I have never ever seen any kind of tension or fight or problem between all these different people. So what are these leaders talking about? What is this problem between all these different groups, etc.? We can solve our things there on the Camino, where the circumstances are not always easy. You know, you got your blisters and you got your pains and you got your problems, and it starts to rain and you have other issues, or it's too hot and you don't have water. People help each other, people share. And that is such a motivating thing to see. And I think I wrote somewhere, at least I've mentioned it in some talks that I gave, I think what we should do someday is just get all the world leaders together and drive them in their limousines to Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port in the Pyrenees and give them a backpack and say, we will see you in a month from now in Santiago. And all, what is it, 200 countries, all 200 of you, you just walk west, and in about a month, you have sorted everything out because you've experienced that you need each other and that you're not so different from each other. Call me some kind of old age peacenik, but I think it would be a nice idea if this way we could solve the problems in the world. I know it's not very realistic, but I keep hoping.
I think you should get in touch with your old diplomatic contact and suggest that as a way of pursuing international relations from now on. It's brilliant. Brilliant. I'm curious to hear what you learned about yourself during this journey.
I've thought about that a lot because no news is coming in and there's no deadlines. You really have time to reflect on life. Where am I in this stage of life? What have I done in the past? But more importantly, what do I want to do in the future? At different moments while you're in the Camino, you either walk alone. For instance, I prefer to walk alone in the morning when I wake up, especially before my first cup of coffee. I prefer to walk alone. And later in the day, I normally join other people that I meet, and there's a lot of discussions. And you see that a lot of people, because they are walking the Camino, or they're walking the Camino because of it, whatever leads to the other, a lot of people are thinking about these things. So what do I want to do now? And that is, I normally never have the time for that. So I think that is, you know, you reflect on people that you've known and that are no longer there. You thought about choices you've made in the past. Did I make the right choices? And what shall I do with the years that I have still left? I hope there are many, but there's also so many opportunities. You can't do everything.
Very, very true. Before we move on, I want to remind listeners that if you're enjoying today's Ready Living podcast episode, please subscribe and help spread the word so more people can learn from magnificent guests like Alexander. And I'd like to switch to security diplomacy and governance now, starting with your involvement with the Planetary Security Initiative. You've been involved in planetary security issues for many years. In fact, back when you were still working as a diplomat, you led the team that launched the Netherlands Ministry of Foreign Affairs Planetary Security Initiative, where a consortium of leading think tanks convened in November 2015 in The Hague, the first of four major planetary security conferences, I believe, that ended up taking place. Can you share with us the main outcomes and recommendations that came from these gatherings and any tangible steps that were taken?
I think the main outcome of this initiative is that it put the relationship between climate change and security much higher on the international agenda, especially on the UN. We were not the first to talk about the relationship between climate change and security, because that had been debated by experts already for 20 years or so. But that was a relative small group of experts that was writing about it. There were some think tanks, mostly in Washington, D.C., some in London, and some in a few other places. They were working on this relationship. It hadn't yet received the kind of traction that it really appeared in international conferences, and that policymakers were working on it. So what Planetary Security did was, for the very first time, we organized a conference that was only dedicated to the relationship between climate change and security. It was the first time that we really brought together on an annual basis the best experts in the world, combined with policymakers from ministries, foreign affairs, and ministries of defense at a high level, director generals and directors. I chose planetary security as a title because it is about overstepping our planetary boundaries, which was, of course, a known concept already at that moment, to say it's more than climate change. It is also about the biodiversity loss in the world. It's also about pollution, and there's all kinds of other measures you can take. So basically, we're reaching the limits of the capacity of the Earth has for us, the way that we live. And security also got a wider interpretation. It's not only in the sense of conflict between states or groups within a state, but it also encompassed human security. So it brought a lot of different approaches together in one new concept. And I think it has certainly helped, but nothing in the world of diplomacy happens because of one event, but it has certainly helped, certainly contributed to put the issue on the map of the United Nations. Soon after this started, a lot more initiatives in that field started, especially in UN Security Council meetings on these kind of aspects. Yeah, diplomacy is always a long-term gain of small steps, which not always really directly, concretely measurable outcomes. It's not like, let's say somebody builds a house and when you're ready, you can just see the house that is built. It's about influencing. It's about moving an issue forward. I think it was helped by the fact that for a very long time, scientists have been warning about climate change. It's actually 19th century knowledge. And the warnings became much more serious from the 1980s onward. But you didn't see it. You could read about it. You could read the scientific report that things were really changing somewhere. But it's only in the past 5 or maybe 10 years that you and I actually experienced it, that, you know, you could walk the Camino and you're in that, caught in that heat wave that shouldn't be there by the normal statistics and all kinds of other examples. So that has helped. And I think now that politicians are still slowly but increasingly taking climate change more serious, has very much to do with the fact that you can't deny it anymore because you experience it every day. So that has helped the momentum of planetary security too.
That leads me to the next thing I want to talk about, which is a TED Talk that you gave a couple of years ago titled "Our Failure to Imagine Planetary Security Threats." And in your talk, you criticize governments as entities that, and I'm quoting here, in all their different forms and levels, often don't reward imagination. So for every disaster, there's always the story of the expert that had been warned but was not listened to. Climate change falls precisely into that category. And you've also commented that the world needs, again, I'm quoting here, brave visionary leadership instead of short-term patchwork solutions to the latest manifestation of the structural changes in the planet's ecosystems that will permanently alter our living conditions. You've lamented politicians who try to tackle global problems by last-minute decisions, even though we elected them to plan strategically for a better long-term future for our kids and us. You note that politicians and CEOs are supposed to map out our journey much better. They're like tour guides in a city. They plan, lead, and we follow. At least that is what they are supposed to do. What do you feel politicians and governments should be doing to better handle the security implications of climate change and other planetary security risks?
Well, what you would love to see is really leaders with a long-term vision. Take somebody like Winston Churchill, who, unlike any other politician around him, said at the right moment, we really, really have to continue this war, even if we are standing here alone, because this is the right thing to do. And those kind of politicians, maybe you can talk for a long time about what was good and wrong about Winston Churchill, but at that case, making such statement and having the vision to lead, it's not that we only have cowards as political leaders, because that's not the case. It is that the structure is made in such a way that it's difficult for them to really take long-term visionary decisions because you have elections every 4 years. And it's the same with the CEOs in big companies. These are not all, you know, terrible people that are out there to destroy the world, but the way that they got in that position and the way that they are judged by how well they do their job by the shareholders, and they just look at the value that they get back from their investment. You can't expect all those shareholders in a company to suddenly become green people that invest in a better world. So it's very much how the structure is. And then sometimes you find leaders that are more brave than the others and that really steer around. I mean, if you look, for instance, knowing that you are sitting in the US, you first had a president who called climate change an absolute hoax, and that it was the hoax was produced by China, if I remember the quote correctly. And then Joe Biden took over. He did so much more positive things. He really promoted the transformation to a renewable energy country that at least invests a lot in it. He combined it with a clever infrastructure bill that also created jobs, etc. So he managed to tackle several problems at the same time. There's ample ground for criticism, which will probably remain the case with most presidents. I mean, he gave out far more drilling licenses than Donald Trump, who might be screaming drill, baby drill, but the one that was actually drilling was Joe Biden. Within the limits of what Biden could do, I think he really tried to steer the country to a much better direction. And of course, within his administration, you find people that are really pushing for more of a green transition. To really lead visionary, it's not always possible for everyone. But for instance, if you look at the Secretary General of United Nations, Guterres, I think he is clearly a leader who keeps reminding the world leaders how urgent it is to take action. And he refers to the science, and he is not only talking about climate action itself, but he also looks at the conditions that are needed, which means international cooperations. It means that you have to tackle the issues of poverty and inequality. And basically, I could mention all the 17 SDGs now that need to be part of this equation. But you can't get there by just tackling one aspect, climate action. You need to do it as a concrete thing, and you need to do it urgently.
So I'm curious to hear your thoughts about two things. And one is the connection between climate change contributing to the rise of extremist organizations and how they exploit environmental conditions. And the other is about how climate change can lead to increased migration and potential conflicts over resources and how these dynamics might play out in different regions of the world.
Yeah, you see more and more examples of this. Weather is getting more extreme, so you see more frequent droughts. They are longer, they are more severe, they have more impact. On the other hand, you see more bursts of rainfall because the atmosphere gets warmer. You can see the same thing in your shower. It then absorbs more moisture, and somewhere that water is coming out again. So you see a lot of floodings. I mean, right now when we do this talking, you see in Eastern Europe absurd amounts of floodings. But you see at the same time, you see in the Amazon region, you see extreme drought, for instance. So these extremes are increasing. At a certain moment, you reach a threshold where you can't live somewhere anymore. Let's say if you look at the Sahel region, nomadic herdsmen are moving around with their cattle. At a certain moment, it has become so dry and there's no more food left for the cattle that they simply die. And then the only option you might still have is to move to one of the areas where there is still water. But in that area, there's also farmers that need that little water that is left to grow their crops. Otherwise, their families are starving. That's an easy concept and this is happening as we speak, where all kinds of tensions between different groups that are making use of that small amount of water is taking place. And you see the same thing happening between countries when there's a lack of water. Take, for instance, Ethiopia building the Gerd Dam, taking water off the Nile, and then Egypt claiming that is our water that we need downstream in Egypt. So increasingly, you will find tensions in the world between upstream and downstream countries. And one of the results of this is that you see more and more migration. The migration that gets a lot of attention in Europe and the US is mainly about immigrants moving from poorer countries to the West. But that is only a fraction of the real migration and internal displacement that is taking place in the world. The overwhelming majority of migrants don't want to migrate very far. They have to, but they can't go very far. So they either go to the nearest city, which gives all kinds of problems in the city and the city infrastructure, or they move a bit further. And then sometimes you have a situation that with the sources available, they could maybe invest in one in the family that moves up further away. And then, let's say, if you're in Northern Africa, the logical choice is that you move northwards instead of southwards. And the same as if you're in Mexico, you move up north and you don't try to move further south. So that gives a lot of attention to the migrants coming into our Western countries. There are enormous challenges further south. And that pleads again for much more international solidarity. This planet is so small, you can just, in 24 hours, you fly to the other side of the world. It's just one planet. We are stuck in this vast and cold and black universe. We're just marooned on this one rock with 8 billion people. The only way we can get out of here is out of this problem is by cooperating and by being flexible. And then it's natural that you should ask more flexibility from the ones that have the money and the power and the knowledge and the technology to solve these problems, and that you don't start somewhere in a very poor country that has no responsibility at all for the problem that we find ourselves in.
So everything we've said seems to emphasize the point that climate diplomacy ties into planetary security.
Yes, yeah, it's very much connected. I mean, too, you can't solve climate change without diplomacy. You need a lot more to solve climate change, but it's an essential ingredient for the simple reason that here we talk about a pollution problem that is, by definition, crossing the borders. When I grew up in the 1970s and 80s, pollution and environmental problems that I remember from seeing in the evening on the news, they were always local problems. So it was about an old factory that was closed down, but the ground was polluted. And maybe that pollution ended up in the water and was then transported a bit. And when it really got international, it was maybe the acid rain that we all remember. And nowadays, the problems we talk about in the world are really global problems. Any energy that I use today will impact everybody in the world a little bit. It's the same with the plastic pollution in the oceans, or the melting of the glaciers, or dying out of biodiversity. All of these things are related to each other. So create the problems together and we have to solve them together.
Pretty much all reasonable people agree that we've got to take immediate action on climate change, but there is still a lot of disagreement about what that should look like and who specifically should be taking this action. As a whole, wealthier countries are disproportionately responsible for the climate crisis, so there's an understandable resentment on part of developing nations for calls that they not increase their consumption of climate-stressing energy sources like fossil fuels as they work to raise their own standard of living. What role do you think wealthier countries should take in terms of leading the way on climate change and sustainability, both in terms of their domestic policies and in terms of economically supporting developing nations? And what obligations do you think developing nations have in this regard?
Well, first of all, where we have to start, and we are starting on it, is for the wealthier countries to reduce our emissions. These are our emissions. Historically, we've them in the West. We're still a huge contributor to it, but now other countries, in China, for instance, are part of the problem. But we have a historic responsibility as well as a present-day responsibility to really reduce our emissions. Then what we also need to do is to help out the countries in the South that are now dealing with a problem that we have created for them. That means in climate financing that we should help them out. But you could also think about, for instance, transfer of technology. Technological solutions are by far mostly created in the West. You could think of an easy transfer there. There's also a kind of win-win situation that instead of expecting these countries in the global South to follow exactly the path that we did, which is something like 200 years of industrial revolution, and then finally you go to renewables, that you help them now immediately to move towards renewables, and especially with solar that is going so rapidly now. It is so efficient. We should help, and we have to help to build the capacity. And that means also education and training. And you need good governance to solve these issues as well. And these things should not be in a vacuum. I already mentioned the global goals, the sustainable development goals. That is not by accident just a list of 17 things we should look at, or 169 targets. But this is a very cleverly thought out integrated approach. And we have to move on all these challenges, because you can't solve climate change by only looking specifically at climate. You can ask the developing nations to be on board in this process, because you want them also to move towards more sustainable practices, and that they sign up and ratify to international climate agreements. I mean, the Paris Agreement is the first one you can think of. Other agreements where you can work together and to create a more resilient culture, because we in the West are more resilient to the changes in climate. We're already very much caught unaware, as the example I gave of the floodings in Europe now. These are rich nations that are dealing with huge problems. If you don't have the kind of resilience in your infrastructure and in society to deal with these kind of problems, that makes it much harder. So there's expertise that where the West can help the countries of the global south. Summarizing, we're all in this together. We need to help each other. There's a huge responsibility for the ones that have the means to tackle climate change to help the other countries that find themselves in this situation of climate change.
On a broader scale, you commented in one of your newsletters that America's democracy is a cornerstone for the stability we all need, especially since we live in dangerous times of multiple threats that all compound each other. Can you elaborate on what you see as the key threats that make America's democracy stability so crucial on a global scale?
We've had a century where America was the dominating power in the world. I think many historians pinpoint that 1917, the year that the U.S. For the first time came to Europe to help us out in solving a second the First World War, and they had to do it a second time again, of course. Now we're in a century where we move much more towards a kind of multipolar world. In that situation, it is crucial that America stays a stable power, that such a kind of change doesn't go too soon from one situation to another. It's a very vulnerable situation. And then looking now at American politics after 4 years of Trump government and now the elections that are coming up, I'm very worried that the stability of the United States is at stake. I mean, of course, all the voters in America should decide themselves whom they want to have as a president. But the U.S. is a cornerstone within NATO that guarantees the security of the Western countries. We need wise and stable government in the U.S., and that's in everybody's interest in the whole world. I very much hope that things will go well on the 5th of November in your country.
I think everybody hopes that, whichever way they vote, right? and so I'm wondering what lessons from history, such as the rise of fascism in the 1930s, do you believe are most relevant to the political landscape in 2024?
Well, I've written quite a few articles recently about parallels between the rise of fascism in Italy and especially in Nazi Germany in the late 20s and the early 30s. And it's scary how many parallels there are. It's a group of people that is deliberately creating chaos and then claiming that they are the only ones that can solve the chaos that they have for large extent created themselves, creating fear between different groups in society with the aim of creating such a chaos and then being the one to solve it. You see those parallels all the time. So now with Donald Trump claiming that immigration is the biggest problem, that he's the only one that can solve it, when there was recently a well thought out bill to tackle the immigration problems, he instructed his people to vote against it because he needs chaos to be the savior of that kind of chaos. So there are so many parallels. The same is like the use of modern media. The modern media in the 1920s was the radio, and people were used to a radio telling the truth, because the radio speaker says it started. So after about 1910, was that a radio speaker was somebody who exactly told the situation as it was in the world. There wasn't any spinning of the media. So the Nazis made very clever use of radio and made use of the fact that people believed their radio. Now it's the same with social media. As when somebody sees something printed on their screen, there's the kind of natural feeling of believing that that is true. It is written by somebody, so it has a kind of higher status than somebody that is boasting in a cafe about something that he has heard. And then suddenly, kind of created authorities, either by populist leaders like Trump or created authorities on the media, can have an unexpectedly huge following and impact, far more than you would like to see. And then suddenly, cats and dogs in Springfield, Ohio, is suddenly a thing that people are talking about, and it has real life consequences. There's now dozens of buildings that have been closed because of bomb threats, etc. So out of a completely fake and debunked story about one cat that was maybe eaten by somebody, and that is absolutely not true, that is then promoted to such a scale that you see this kind of chaos. And that resembles also very much the darkest days of fascism in the 1930s.
Well, with regard to the woman whose cat is under discussion here, she had admitted she was wrong about it and went to her neighbors and apologized for this. Unfortunately, that hasn't made the same headlines as the initial claim, and certainly not throughout the United States, maybe locally in that community, but not throughout the whole country around the world. But she did fortunately see the error in what she had done and tried to make amends. The question is just, was it good enough? Probably not.
Yeah. I read it in the New York Times as well. She was mentioned, and also the name of the cat. Of course, this is not her fault. I mean, you shouldn't do a thing like she did, but she has not caused this. The person that has created this complete chaos and this hatred between different communities has a name. That's Donald Trump, together with J.D. Vance. It's his state, by the way. I mean, that is fascinating. So we have here a candidate as the vice president of the United States who comes from Ohio. He is representing these people. People have voted for him to represent them as a senator, first-time senator in Washington, D.C. And what does he give back to the state that has sent him there to this beautiful job in Washington, D.C.? He creates chaos and hatred. I mean, what kind of agenda is that? What kind of person are you if you play with the people like this?
Well, that brings me to the next question, which is, what are your thoughts on how individuals and institutions can maintain a sense of urgency without falling into disillusionment? And what are some of the critical actions we can take now to leverage our agency in creating a positive and sustainable future?
Yeah, I think it comes back again to turning the page on the situation that we are in now. Worldwide, we have seen a wave of nationalism. It's often right wing, but not always. But it's very much this negative nationalist vibe, which plays the card of hopelessness. We can't solve these issues unless you have one leader that solves everything for you, which of course is not going to work. I think a very recent trend is maybe just not even, it didn't even start with the day that Kamala Harris took over from Joe Biden, is very much this talk, let's stop this permanent chaos, creating of new tensions, etc. Let's leave it behind us, and let's just unite at least behind the thought that we go back to a normal kind of politics where you can disagree with each other, where you search to find compromise, and where you work towards solutions. It's a kind of vibe that is suddenly everywhere in the social media. I think it's also very much a message of the Harris-Walz candidacy. And it seems to get more and more traction. And it makes so much sense. Basically saying what has been happening has been very weird. Let's stop this. Let's do normal again, because the problems we are facing are so huge. We spoke earlier about climate change. I think if historians, 100 years from now, if we're still around on this planet, if we haven't wiped each other out, if we still have historians 100 years from now, and they will describe the 20th century, they will shake their heads in disbelief when they look at what was happening in this time. There was this enormous problem, which was the environmental problem, that our economy, our neoliberal system of how we organize, how we earn our money, how we run our economy, and our whole society has neglected for far too long, has neglected for so long that we now threaten to make life practically impossible on this planet. That is the problem that needs to be solved, and it's related to all kinds of questions of inequality, etc. And instead of working on that issue, we're talking about cats and dogs in Ohio? How is this possible that at this time, when it is so adamant that we need to take climate action, we're far too late, that we still don't focus on the key issue? I mean, even in the debate between Kamala Harris and Trump, she mentioned climate change in one line maximum, even though we know that she was an original supporter of the Green New Deal. She probably can't because of her voters, and he didn't even react to the word climate change, didn't even mention it. That is the issue of our time.
Well, you mentioned social media and the importance of social media in current events and in all sorts of other important issues as well. And I want to talk about your social media followers. You've got almost 500,000 people engaging with you on social media and thousands of people who have joined your community on Substack. Obviously, the topics you cover, which range from travel, history, current events, science, culture, and geography, as well as the stories you tell, resonate with lots of people. Why do you think your content speaks so deeply to people?
Probably because all of us have children or no children or have grandchildren, and we are worried about the next generation. We feel that we leave this planet behind and that we didn't do a good job. Our generation has been pretty horrible in the results that we leave. Having lived our lives, we had the fantastic fortune of not having war for, what is it, about 80 years now, which is the good half of the 20th century, because in the first half of 20th century, we've been murdering each other out by tens of millions at unimaginable scale and cruelty. And the second half of the 20th century, we were doing much better. We had realized that we shouldn't create a third world war. There were a lot of tensions and difficulties. There were local conflicts, etc. But basically, we did quite well. It even got better in the 1990s when this kind of bipolar world was at its end, when the horrors of communism seemed to come to an end. Then we had fantastic chances to really create a good world for everybody. We missed that chance. We are now, what is it, 30 years further. And those are mostly the 30 years that I've been active in all kinds of issues. And if I look back now in what my generation has achieved, we should be pretty negative. I'm getting close to 60 now. I'm getting close to this age that I'm looking back. I'm deeply worried for what will come in the future. And I, as I said, I've worked for some 30 years on climate change. I see what is coming there. I see the other big picture, the huge challenges in governance, that people don't believe what they read anymore. People don't believe in science, the complete nonsense of people not believing in vaccinations and those kind of things. Vaccinating is also something that you do for other people, not only for yourself. And it seems that we're turning backwards. We move to the very small, our own little interest. There's less solidarity. And I think generally there's also less hope. We have to turn this narrative around and realize that there are a lot of challenges, but we can solve them. We should work together and we should really look at huge challenges in history, realize that we could tackle those as well. I mentioned the problems Winston Churchill was facing in May 1940, he managed to, against all the odds, to lead. This is a similar kind of situation. I mean, this is a kind of situation on whatever, the 7th of December 1941. Suddenly you're under attack, what you didn't expect. And look at what the U.S. did in 1942 and 43 in just massively turning around the whole economy to face the enemy. And this time we have a similar kind of enemy. It looks different. It's called climate change and environmental challenges. Recognize this challenge and just completely turn around the whole society and economy and the leadership to tackle these challenges. I think we can. We know how to do it. We have the technology. We have the money to do it. We talk about a few percent of the GDP. That's all that we have to offer. And if we don't do it, we know that the impact will be far, far worse.
So a few years ago, you wrote that many of the talks and writings you give are about ensuring that we preserve what we cherish for the next generations. You just mentioned that point a few moments ago, and that we need to keep in mind that we are part of an integral part of nature and not the owners who can do with it as we please. So do you see your role as serving as a sort of wake-up warning for others, or do you see yourself as someone who merely records and memorializes our current history so that we have a complete record later on? What role do you think your social media can have in enhancing public understanding and appreciation for human rights, compassion towards animals, and environmental appreciation?
I know from people that I speak and that I write with that I do have a voice and that I do influence people. The best compliment I can get from people is that they said, because of your writing, because of your talking, I see things different now. I appreciate nature more. I'm more worried about climate change, but I do believe in the solutions. Those kind of things. Sometimes when I hear that back, wow, that is so fascinating, because I have a voice and I can convince people, but I'm just a very, very little guy. I'm not, whatever, some kind of Elon Musk or so that can reach billions. And unfortunately, in this example, he gives exactly the wrong message. He put the question on X, Twitter that he owns, something formulated like, why haven't there yet been assassinations on the Democratic candidates? It seems he is either pure evil or he has no sense of what the impact of those words can be. Some people see him as the kind of messiah to follow on anything, technology or whatever he says, they take for real. He's playing with fire. And there are so many leaders in this world, not necessarily elected leaders, but people in a very influential leader role that don't see that. So going back to your question of my role, I try to give people hope. I try to give people another perspective. I try to explain the world around us. And I try to give more feeling for a respect for animals and a respect for nature and make sure that we realize that we are part of nature. The way how we are now dealing with the beauty of nature on our planet, destroying the rainforest, wiping out animal species. We're now in a state that only about 3 or 4% of all animals in the world are wild animals. The other 96-97% is locked up in cages, are treated horribly, and then presented as meat in our supermarkets. Also, by the way, contributing to the problem of climate change. Again, these future historians looking back at this century, they will again be appalled by the way that the very same people that spoke with human rights completely forgot about animal rights. And that is part of how to appreciate nature. I try to encourage people to go out in nature. I mean, that is part of this story of the Camino. Leave your offices and your screens and your iPhones and just pack that backpack. Do for just 1 month in your life, do something different and go out in nature and make that walk. You will see that you reconnect with the environment around you and that you're part of it. I could have sitting somewhere, whatever, inside in a library with my laptop with the air conditioning on, and I would have only read in the newspaper clippings that there was outside a heat wave without knowing it. Well, walk through it, and it's like, hey, I am actually part of nature. And those are, yeah, probably the kind of messages I want to give. It's in three pillars. I mean, one is we have to be aware of the threats that we are dealing with, like climate change. And second is that you can't only be scared for that the whole time. You have to realize what is at stake. And therefore, you have to appreciate the beauty of nature. And the third pillar is what connects those. And that is governance. We need good leaders in politics, but also in business and in any other aspect of our society. And that includes every individual. Everybody is a leader at their own scale to make the right decisions. So what can you do? You can fly less. You can stop eating meat. You can do those kind of things. The most important thing, especially in this time frame, what individuals can do is to vote for the right leaders. Go out to vote. Make sure that the people that are going to destroy life on this planet, including our lives as we know it, that those people don't get in power.
You often showcase really stunning travel photography that highlights the beauty of the world. How has your passion for photography influenced the way you experience the world, and how do you think it contributes to the way you share stories and connect with your audiences?
Photography is maybe a kind of meditation, even. If you're a photographer, and I've photographed all my life, nowadays mostly with an iPhone, in the past with much better cameras, when I walk in the streets, I am constantly aware of the beauty around me. I always look as a photographer. What is interesting, what I see, which makes, in a way, life much more intensive because you see so much more beauty. I mean, it could be, you know, a flower creeping out between the stones of the pavement. It could be some children playing, or it could be whatever, a cat passing over the street. Photography is very much related to seeing beauty. It's also why I love to look at photographs taken by the world's best photographers, because these people really do the utmost to capture the most beautiful image. And an image can literally say more than 1,000 words, but people often say it's literally true. So I appreciate the beauty of our planet much more because I'm a photographer. And I photograph it also to share it with the people that follow me either on Patreon or on Substack or on Twitter or anywhere else where I'm active.
On your social media accounts, you also intertwine historical narratives with contemporary events. And I read somewhere that 8 out of 10 books you read are history books, and that if you were a time traveler, you would choose to go back in time. So I want to know, what historical periods fascinate you the most and why, and what do you think we can learn about them that's applicable to life today?
There will be so many times I would love to go back to. I think I've read a lot in my lifetime about maritime history. I have an enormous amount of books. I think I have already at least 10 or 15 books about the island of Pitcairn, which is just 4.5 kilometers. That's where the mutineers of the Bounty settled in 1789. I've read a lot about, let's say, James Cook and William Bligh and all these kind of explorers in the late 18th century and 19th century. That was a time when our planet was so much bigger, because it took you a year to get to the other side of the world, and instead of just sitting in a jumbo jet and fly to Australia or something. So that time would be absolutely fascinating to experience. At the same time, we always have the risk of romanticizing past so much. You shouldn't think about whatever, having to go to a dentist or to a surgeon in those days, or being tried in court if you were a suspect. You don't want to sit on one of those ships of James Cook. It's lovely to read about it, but you didn't want to eat that food or sit between those rats on board or anything else. Yeah, that's a fascinating time. I think I would love to go back 2,000 years and see what was happening in the Holy Land in those days, because it seems that after 2,000 years, quite some different interpretations have been given by different people about what really happened there. I would love to go back to the 1960s, which has been so decisive ultimately on world politics. I always wonder what would happen if Robert Kennedy would not have been murdered. People always focus on Ronald Reagan. I always go back a little bit more to that moment, and then the Democratic Convention, everything that followed afterwards. History is fascinating. If you put it the other way around, would there be a period where you would not like to see how it really was? I would find it difficult, because history is an endless source of learning and inspiration.
We need to create that time machine for you.
I would love to.
You posted a beautiful photograph on Instagram of a trip to Colorado showcasing an open road with a bright blue sky overhead, flecked with white clouds and framed by tall pine trees. As you continue to blend your travels, historical insights, and reflections on nature through your social media presence, what future places and adventures are you most excited to explore and share in the coming years?
No, I would love to travel always. I hope next year to do at least one other through hike, one of the other Camino routes, maybe the Camino del Norte following the coastline, or maybe starting in Portugal, or maybe hike here much more Norway. I recently moved to Norway, and there's beautiful landscapes here to explore. I always loved traveling in the American West. The picture you refer to is interesting. I still would like to find the time someday to write a book, which would then be about this journey. It's one of the options. Last year, I followed the Colorado River all the way from its source, as close as I could get there in April, because I couldn't really do the last mile or so to where the source was. It was close near Rocky Mountains National Park. But I started there, and I kept following the Colorado River all the way to the American-Mexico border. which is also where the river more or less ends, because all the water goes into a canal towards California. A little bit of water sometimes still reaches Mexico, but it doesn't reach the Sea of Cortez. It just vaporizes in the middle of the desert. So for nearly 2 weeks, I followed the Colorado River. I spoke to many Americans, including many that vote for Donald Trump. I discovered what a lovely, nice people these people often are. They offered me apple pie. They repaired the car when it broke down. And they were wonderful people voting for somebody who I would not describe in those words. I saw beautiful nature. I have so many stories to tell. The idea of making this trip was also inspired by climate change, because the American West is in severe long-term problems because of the water shortages. There's just not enough water compared to the demand of water. That is a story that kind of weaves through this trip. And I've often been there. I can nearly say that I start to know the area well, because I've traveled so much there. I just love that part of the US. I hope to go back there. And for the rest, I think my travel will mainly be in Europe, because now, after so many years of traveling all over the world, Europe is for me the part of the planet that is the most diverse in people and history and its cities, and it's so beautiful and there's so much to do and it's safe to travel here and things are relatively nearby. You don't have to fly. It's amazing to explore Europe. If there would be one region where I would have to live the rest of my life and I was not allowed to leave, I would vote for Europe.
We've been talking a lot about social media, and one of the platforms you're very active on is X. It's become completely, undeniably toxic since it changed ownership in 2022, and it appears that a lot of people are exiting the platform as a result. Do you have any thoughts about leaving the platform?
I can well imagine why many people leave the platform, because yes, toxic is the right word. Also, management-wise, it's absolute chaos. Yes, of course, the thought crosses my mind. I'm relatively spending far more time now on Substack that is really growing, especially in the US. I think the rest of the world still has to discover Substack. High hopes that that is going to be a very much an all-round platform with much better content and discussions. But I also feel on X, which I still tend to call Twitter, that I can't just abandon all the people that have been following me there for, 12, 15 years or so. So I'm still active there, but far less than I used to be. I understand fully why so many people left, but I see some very good voices on X are still around, also in the field of climate change, still sharing relevant information. But it's annoying to see how all those trolls are just completely out there, uncontrolled, etc. Because I've been there so long, I know how to find my way. I think for me, it's easier to navigate because I was kind of, let's say, professionally on Twitter. Let's hope for better times. The way it is run now is unsustainable in many ways of the meaning of the word unsustainable. And there are good other platforms popping up as well outside of Substack. For the longer stories, I think Medium is really good. That's more story writing, medium.com. I think anybody who's not yet on Substack, go there, substack.com, and discover what's out there. But there's also Blue Sky, for instance, looks much more like Twitter, is a much cleaner and better version of Twitter with much more civil debate, but it's far smaller. I'm on all those platforms at the same time, Threads as well, Instagram.
But we're also talking in a sense about health. And I read this, you use your smartphone as a way to center yourself with pictures.
I have moments that I find the information I see on my smartphone or my iPad so toxic and so negative and so depressing that just to change my mood, I either go to my own photography, so good memories of friends and family or travels that I made. For instance, last night before going to sleep, I went to YouTube and followed somebody who is doing a long through hike through Norway. There's nothing happening in the video apart from that you see beautiful nature. I sleep much better on that than staying in something like this toxic X environment that has so much negativity. I see so many people with all kinds of mental health challenges, much more out there. I think society recognizes it more, but also on social media, you see it so much more, you read so much more about it. I am not struggling with anything in that field, but I do realize that there are threats by getting too much negativity in your system. That's why I balance balance it with nature. And that is the very same thing as I describe my writing. I mean, I do tell the stories about our planet and where the challenges are, but I also talk about beauty density. It's not only beauty of nature. It could also be a city where I see beautiful old buildings or art or photography or just things of beauty, because that is what inspires us. That's what makes life so beautiful.
Let's not lose sight of the beauty out there and the things that give us joy. And that's why I think you have the large following you do. And by the way, I also have a folder of favorite pictures on my phone that I look at when I need a little lift. And when I do that, I can feel my body relaxing a little bit and my mind becoming calmer.
It's also tested by all kinds of scientists that, for instance, if they show on your screen in a fraction of a second, somebody you love, your partner or children, so short that the one watching the screen hardly realizes it, that it still gives already an impulse of the right hormones and the right feeling. So that's already uplifting. Those things are important. So make sure that, you know, the people you love and the things that give you joy, that you surround yourself with it. And it normally takes a little bit more of an effort because the negative news is more clickable and so easily available. So you have to do a little bit of an effort. But I encourage everybody in general, just search out for things like Substack and also Medium.com, because there's so much more positive and creative news out there than you find on clickbait kind of apps that are either X or the alternatives.
You recently wrote a really touching story about saving bumblebees, and I want to read a part of that for our listeners. And here I'm going to quote. Last summer, I saved several bumblebees I found on the pavement by transferring them to a safe corner of my garden and putting a teaspoon of sugar water next to them. Each bumblebee enjoyed the treat, and it took them only minutes to take off again. I realized my actions added nothing to a structural solution for their challenges, which requires developing and implementing firm climate action policies at the government level. However, if you would ask each of these individual bumblebees, they will likely tell you that this energy shot after removal from a busy sidewalk saved their lives. It often only takes a slight change of perspective to contribute to a better world. And if it's not a better world for all, it's at least a better world for this handful of furry friends. To me, it's things like that that really make a difference, the taking time to notice surroundings and step in when there is an ability to help, even for, and maybe especially for, those who are often overlooked. So I want to say thank you for doing that, and thank you for sharing it with everyone. We talked about the Planet Substack, but where else can people find you on social media?
I think on Twitter, still a lot of people are on their Twitter X. So there, the handle is Alex_Fairbake. Substack.com, their search for The Planet. On Medium.com, Instagram, just my full name, Alexander Fairbake. Under either Alex or Alexander Fairbake, you'll find me on all kinds of other platforms too.
Thanks so much for having taken the time today.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to talk together.